Good afternoon, everyone, and we'll begin the conference call. Hello, my name is Michael Grabowitz, and I'm the chairman of the Institute for Literacy and Learning. And thank you for joining us today for the Institute for Literacy and Learning Straight Talk Live Chat Conference Call Series. Today we have the honor of being joined by Dr. Jan Hasbrook. Dr. Hasbrook worked as a reading specialist for 15 years and has taught undergraduate and graduate courses as a university professor. Her research in reading fluency, academic assessment and interventions, and consultations has been widely published. Her most recent book, titled The Reading Coach, is published by Sopras West. Today, Dr. Hasbrook will be discussing using assessment data for RTI decisions. This call is being recorded and will be available in the library section of our website for you and your colleagues' future listening pleasure. Before we begin, I have some very important messages. If you have a question for Dr. Hasbrook during this conference call, please email it to straighttalklivechat@theinstituteforliteracyandlearning.org. Again, this email address for a question is straighttalklivechat@theinstituteforliteracyandlearning.org, no spaces. All emailed questions and their answers will be mailed to everyone registered for this call. Each of you who registered for this conference call will receive an email survey. Please help us serve you better by filling out the 2-minute survey when it's sent to you following this live chat session. The Institute for Literacy and Learning truly appreciates your input, and we use your ideas to improve future calls. In the next few days, please check your inboxes for the next Institute for Literacy and Learning live chat conference call with Dr. Rolanda O'Connor, October 28th at 1 p.m. Eastern Standard Time. Dr. O'Connor will be speaking on teaching older poor readers to read words. And I want to thank you again for joining us today, and now I want to present to you Dr. Jan Hasbrook presenting Using Assessment Data for RTI Decisions. Jan, good afternoon.
Good afternoon, Mike. Thank you, and welcome to everybody on this conference call today. Thank you for making time out of your very busy schedules. I know, especially at this beginning time of the year. The Institute emailed me lists of the folks who had registered for this conference, and I'm very impressed with the wide breadth of positions that you are holding. I know that there are school psychologists and administrators and reading coaches and reading specialists and many other folks listening in today. So I hope that this is a good use of your time, and I'm really looking forward to the questions that you might have at the end, because this topic is certainly worth a lot of in-depth conversation. A lot of confusions and some really important decisions that we all have to make around using data within this RTI mode that we're all attempting. So I'll launch right in. I presume that you all had a chance to download the PowerPoint handouts, and you have those in some form in front of you. And mine start with the image of those children raising their hands in the classroom as a reminder, as we start this conversation, that what we're really talking about is helping every single one of our students achieve success. And I am going to be focusing in on reading. There are many aspects of what I'm going to be discussing today that would be applicable to other content areas, particularly math, but as you may know from my background or heard in the introduction, my specialty is reading. That's where I really have the deepest expertise and knowledge, and it's also, honestly, where we have the most substantial empirical support for using data within RTI. So I am going to focus in on reading, and that is our job. We have a lot of other jobs to do, but a very, very important one, I know you all agree, is to help all of our students learn to read.
I just want to comment, you said about the handouts. If anyone does not have those handouts, they're out on our website at theinstituteforliteracyandlearning.org. And on the front page of the website, there is a click here for handouts under Dr. Jan Hasbrook's speaking engagement today. So if some of you don't have those handouts, that's where you would get them. Sorry, Jan.
No, thanks, Mike. That's it will be helpful, I know. And if you don't have a chance to do that, I hope that my conversation will be sufficient so that you can follow along, but I am just orienting myself with my slides too. So the next slide that I do have there is just a picture of two young people, a young boy and a young girl. The boy is a little bit older. I think of him perhaps as a middle school student, and the little girl is an elementary student. And they're there as a reminder that we need to be thinking about all of our students across the grade levels, but also those are the students' pictures I use to remind me that when we talk about all students, there are always a few students with special needs, extraordinary challenges, or just who struggle with our instruction. So my question is what to do with these students, the ones we think about when we're going home in the evening, the ones that we spend the most time collaborating about. What are we going to do? And the next slide is a listing of the old response. What have we historically done with these students that struggle in learning despite our best efforts? Well, there's always the process that we often affectionately refer to as the wait to fail response. Those of us who have been around in this business for not too long have experienced the frustration for that the mechanisms for serving students often necessitate that we wait until we can get that historically legally mandated IQ achievement discrepancy. And I'm sure all of you have also shared the frustration when sometimes that magic discrepancy number doesn't appear. And we still have students who clearly need our help, but we have in the past not always had the mechanism to serve them. We also find that process of measuring IQ achievement discrepancy sometimes targets students for assistance who don't really need it. So it has not served us or our students really well. An old response I also wrote down on that slide is hope and pray. We can always do that, and I'm sure we'll not give that up. But where we are today is we are being given as professionals a possible better response, one that many people are very excited about. As I'm watching the discussions in professional journals and attending conferences and listening to my colleagues talk about it, I know that there's also a lot of concern about what we are calling response to intervention. There's a lot of excitement, there's a lot of concern, there's a lot of confusion about what it is. Some people are attempting to find the book that has the list of the steps that a district or a school needs to go through for RTI, and although there are good books and articles and websites being created, you're probably that magic 5-step or 10-step process is not going to emerge, because it is a framework for serving students. It is not a step-by-step process. And as we talk about that framework, there's even some disagreement about what it actually means. But I'm going to share with you the perception that I've gleaned from my own work and reading the research that has contributed to response to intervention models and theories, and we'll see if that matches what your thinking is. But to me, as I look at why we're moving in this direction, a real important reason is the goal of prevention. It's the notion that quite the opposite, in fact, the diametric opposite to the wait to fail model is a prevention model, that by using these procedures within the RTI framework, we have some good studies that show when these methods are being used that we reduce the number of students who develop problems from the beginning, especially, of course, when we target kindergarten, first, second, and third grade. And beyond that prevention model, the idea really does start some of the core concepts that I've written down, is that there's this notion that in response to intervention that we must start with the best quality instruction in general education, explicit, systematic, intensive, and I wrote down SBRR, a little acronym for scientifically based reading research. And I wrote that as the first core concept because Again, I think there's a lot of confusion, a lot of misunderstanding that RTI is a special education initiative, that it's all about different ways of doing things with special ed. I see that as the opposite, that it is must be, first and foremost, the implementation of the highest quality instruction in the core curriculum in the classroom, supporting our teachers to offer that. Using the RTI mechanism, we can, in fact, because of the change in special education law, use the mechanism to help us identify students who truly do have a learning disability and ultimately serve them in special ed. But it starts in the regular classroom. One of the other core concepts of RTI framework that I've listed there is the use of frequent assessments. In order to make this work, we really do need to help restructure, in many cases, how our schools are collecting and using assessment data. We'll be doing that. Many people will be doing it far more frequently than they have in the past. And really, that's the purpose of this conversation today, to make sure that the big ideas of that assessment, what are the assessments we ought to be using, and most importantly to me is how we can use, once we've collected that data, how we can actually use it to make good decisions. And the last of the core concepts that I wrote down there on the slide is that we need to immediately respond to the results of assessment data. Again, the opposite of the wait to fail model. Let's aggressively be looking for students who might possibly need help. Let's not wait until they're severely in need. And when we have found them, let's do something this afternoon or tomorrow, and let's not wait for weeks or months or years for lots and lots of assessments or wait until the discrepancy is large enough. The next slide that I have down there for those looking at a slide is a visual image of response to intervention. The visual image of RTI has been represented many ways, often in inverted triangle or pyramid. This is a wedge showing the classic three tiers of RTI. Of course, I'm sure many of you know there isn't any magic rule about needing three tiers or four tiers. Some RTI implementations have five tiers. But the basic idea is that there is tiered service delivery with, as you can see, the arrow on the bottom. What's going up across the tiers, what's gaining in or increasing, is the amount of instructional time across the tiers, the intensity or focus of the instruction across the tiers, the amount of data that we need to collect from the students who are being served in each of these tiers, and the expertise of the teachers. Not meaning that Tier 3 teachers need to be smarter or more credentialed necessarily than the classroom teacher in Tier 1. I really think of that increased expertise as increased collaboration. The more academically or behaviorally needy a student is, the more professional brains ought to be working together to serve those students' needs. So what's going down, what's represented as the narrowing of that wedge, is the number of students being served. That, again, this is not theory. Response to intervention has a fairly solid and multi-decade research base to it that shows that when we do provide the highest quality core instruction in the classroom in Tier 1, that we have perhaps 20 to 30 students who may need some short-term supplementary instruction, and ultimately end up with only 5 to 10 or less than 10% of students really needing the intensive intervention services that are offered in Tier 3. And as we're moving toward this model, which will look different from district to district, it will look different from state to state, there still will be those core principles in place. And as RTI is being implemented in many places, there is, there's been a lot of conversation and reflection about the parallel between what we are attempting to do as professional educators now to the model that physicians have been using for a very long time. So in the next slide, I have a representation of that, this parallel between the physician model and the professional educator model. Because although the medical world has not typically used the terms tier one, tier two, and tier three, it's very obvious that they have delivered services that way, that in the medical world, tier one is the, we'd hope, and many of these ideas are rather idealized, but that everybody would have access to a highly qualified, well-trained physician, and that you would see that person at least once a year for an annual checkup, go in, get some screening assessment data collected on you. If everything looks okay, meaning that you have are determined by your physician based on the data to be at the benchmark for your age and gender and wellness, etc., then you're done. You don't need any additional services from the medical world. If any of those quick screening assessments that a physician administers do show that you are not at benchmark, they may order some additional assessments, diagnostic assessments perhaps, to figure out what really is wrong, and perhaps design in Tier 2 a short-term focused intervention for your health to help get you back to the standards of health and wellness of Tier 1. If any of those tests reveal that the medical needs are greater, the medical world is very well set up for service delivery in Tier 2, very intensive care, usually involving a team of professional medical service people. But one of the things I find about this parallel model is something that we need, I believe strongly, that we need to be emulating as professional educators, and that is a goal in the medical world is very clear that if patients are being served in the most intensive service level, perhaps an intensive care in a hospital, the goal in the medical world is to clearly move them out of there as quickly as they possibly can. The medical world always focuses in on the standards of health and wellness and helps move people toward those standards. I think as we are moving towards standards-based instruction, we could use that model of always thinking, no matter where our students are being served, tier one, tier two, or tier three, every student deserves to be given the opportunity to achieve the standards for that student's age and grade appropriateness, and to help move them there with every service that we possibly can provide. I think that's, to me, that's a real clear goal of RTI. Of course, the next two slides really are a reminder, too, that is, if we buy into this notion of the parallel between the medical world and the educator's world, that we don't want to go backwards. The medical world used to really have this notion of just finding out what's wrong with a patient and prescribing some kind of pill or intervention. We would be better served as educators to follow what the medical world has done with a more holistic approach of looking at the causal factors. On the next slide, I listed stress or genetics or nutrition, environmental factors, et cetera. We just want to avoid the blame the patient or blame the student kind of notion. What's going on? What does the student need? How can we change that? So when we think again about RTI and how we're going to respond to it, many people are also looking for some kind of framework for academic success, and I've shared here, and some of you may have heard other presentations on this, a framework for academic success that has the acronym of SAILS, S-A-I-L-S. This framework was developed by my colleague, Dr. Carolyn Denton, and I when we were getting ready to write the book that Mike mentioned, the Reading Coach book. Some of the researchers in coaching have said that, have determined that coaching is a very effective model, but it won't be as effective if it's not implemented within a framework for academic success. But very few of those researchers mentioned what the framework should be. So Carolyn and I did an extensive long-term review of effective schools research and came up with these five components that effective schools pay attention to: the standards, to collecting and using assessment data. Clearly, they put a lot of time and attention into instruction and intervention, supported by leadership and a sustained system-wide commitment. And I'm sharing that today because the assessment piece that we are going to focus on for this conversation is really the assessment piece. And I have on that next slide the four categories of assessments that at least in the reading world, we are often referring to those these days as the category of assessment data that the categories of assessments that we should be using, collecting data, and using for professional decision making. Those categories are the benchmark screening assessments, the diagnostic assessments, the assessments for progress monitoring, and the outcome assessments. And with my own personal background, both in the classroom and as a researcher, I do know that many teachers and administrators are quite overwhelmed by assessments, unsure about when to use them and how to use them and why to use them, and that people are spending so much time collecting assessment data that I think it's important for us to remember that each of these categories of assessments is actually really designed to answer a fairly simple question. So I think these questions are profoundly important, but in essence, they're pretty simple, and I think most teachers understand that they need to be answered. So benchmark screening assessments are designed to answer the question, which of our students might possibly need some extra assistance. They're not designed to be any more definitive than that, but I think most educators agree that's an important question to answer. Let's not, again, wait until it's obvious they need help, but let's go look for the ones who might need the help. Diagnostic assessments are the tools that we can use to help answer the question, what are this individual student's strengths and needs? And we can use that to plan our interventions or instruction. Progress monitoring. This is a set of assessment tools that we can use to help underscore and answer the question about whether a student is actually learning. We may watch a student moving steadily through a curriculum, but that may not indicate that learning is happening. And then the fourth category, outcomes assessments, is the larger picture, the large-scale, high-stakes assessments that usually are administered on a yearly basis that are linked to standards progress. Many of the assessments that we're using these days were based on the extensive research conducted by numbers of people now over the last 25 or 30 years. That body of research is often referred to as curriculum-based measurement research, CBM. It has evolved tremendously over the last 24, 25 years. Originally, the idea was that assessments did, in fact, need to be based directly in the student's curriculum. Those notions have evolved over time, but we still often refer to those as CBM. But that research base that was, there was a lovely review conducted in the April 2007 Journal of Special Education on the whole history of CBM research, and there were articles for summarizing the research in reading and in math and some of the others. I have a PDF copy of the summary of the reading research from the Journal of Special Ed, and I do offer to send that to people. If you don't have a copy of the Journal of Special Ed readily available to you and you might like to read the summary of that research, I would be happy to send one to you. There's a couple of other things along the way that I'm going to offer to send along as well, and I'll give you the contact information for me when we finish up.
Hey, Jan?
Yes.
Jan, if you send that to the Institute, we'll make sure we blast it out to everyone that was on the call today.
Okay. Okay, I can do that.
Survey information.
Yeah. Okay. Very good. Mm-hmm. Thank you.
Okay,
so proceeding along, to continue this parallel between the physicians and the educators,
looking at using some of that those assessments to initially start the process. If a patient walked into a physician's office, the physician might start by saying, "So how are things going? Does there seem to be any problems?" And what a physician would begin to be thinking about is collecting initially the screening data to determine if the person, if the patient is at benchmark or not for health and wellness. For us, in as educators, we use benchmark screening typically 3 times a year, in the fall, in the winter, in the spring for reading. When we get a score on a benchmark screener, it often helps us determine students being in one of two categories, that they, if their score puts them at benchmark, then that indicates that they, we can interpret that as being likely on track if there are no other indicators of concern that we should be paying attention to. If the score is below the expected benchmark, we can make the determination that that student might, in fact, need some extra assistance. If it's quite far below benchmark, they might need intensive or tier 3. If it's slightly below benchmark, that might be an indicator of some need for tier 2 or supplementary instruction. The next slide talks about some of the benchmark screening procedures. We have to decide which students to assess, and these days, increasingly, at least in elementary schools, all students are being assessed in K through 5 using those quick fluency-based assessments that came out of the CBM research. Using unpracticed passages, students read them for a minute, collect words correct per minute. That's very, very familiar to, I'm sure, many people on this conference call. And on the next slide, it shows 3 of the better known of the fluency-based assessments that are being used for benchmark screening. The Dibbles assessment, developed out of the University of Oregon, the RFBA, the Reading Fluency Benchmark Assessor, that was developed by the Read Naturally folks, that's a K-8 assessment, and the AIMSWeb assessments by Ed Formation. If you looked at all 3 of those assessments, they would look very, very similar to each other on the surface because they're all based on that same research base, the CBM research. So the basic procedures are identical. Some of the logistics that are involved in the tools and processes are a little bit different. But as we are using more and more benchmark screening, we certainly hear a lot of concerns. I don't ever talk about benchmark screening where I don't have one person in the audience raising the question as written here on the slide. The concern is, by many people, how can we believe that such a short, a 60-second measure of one single isolated reading skill, reading fluency, can be used to determine proficiency in this highly complex task of reading? There are various ways that that question is asked, but I think it's a very fair question. I really do, and I'm glad people are asking it. But I also want people to understand there really are 2 answers about why we're doing this. One of them is this notion that fluency assessments for benchmark screening is like a thermometer. It's used in that kind of way by professional educators, that thermometers and fluency assessments have some strong parallels. They both have been shown to be valid and reliable measures, and in both cases, we get a score that's compared to a benchmark thermometer. That benchmark has been set at body temperature for a well human being, that benchmark at 98.6, which has actually been adjusted up a little bit since we're not using mercury thermometers anymore. The AMA has now set that as between, I think, 96.2 and 97.1 or something like that. Of course, for fluency benchmarks, we have the Hasbrouck and Tyndall norms or other norms that are out there. But what we want teachers to understand is that, very much like a thermometer, it's only one indicator. If a human body temperature came out at the normal range, a physician knows that that doesn't mean that there's nothing wrong. There could be quite a bit going on that's still worthy of attention, even with a normal body temperature. As well, if the thermometer read 103 degrees, that's an indicator that something's wrong, but it doesn't tell us what is wrong. So what we need to help teachers understand, administrators and others who are using benchmark screening, is that it's worthwhile to go get the score, just like a physician would never see you without taking your temperature, because it's a very important piece of information. But we need to interpret it and look and see if there are other indicators that we should be paying attention to. So that's one response to answer the questions about concerns about benchmark screening. And the second is listed there, is that research on curriculum-based measurement. It is really shown to be a valid and reliable tool for collecting information for key decisions, such as is this, which of our students might need some extra help. So moving on with the analogy, if a physician has collected screening data and it does seem to be a concern, they might follow up with some diagnostic data that helps answers what are the particular needs of a patient, or for us, what are the particular academic strengths and needs so that we can design instruction. The next diagram on that next slide shows that typically we administer diagnostic assessments after the benchmark screening. Once we've found students who might need help, that's when we administer additional diagnostic assessments, not typically to every single student. Although on the next slide it does say, although we typically give these diagnostic assessments, and I need to stop here because I've neglected to be clear about something, because a lot of people use that term diagnostic as differently than I'm using it. I'm not meaning diagnostic here for determining a disability or a handicapping condition for special education eligibility. That's a whole different kind of assessment. These are diagnostic of specific skills. So we typically do those only for students we have some concern about. However, on that one slide it does say in some schools people are using quick diagnostic assessments for all students in kindergarten 1 and even up until second grade, because that's such a critical and vulnerable time for students to acquire reading that we just want to double check to make sure that every student is as strong as we hope them that they would be. The other procedures, of course, is we look for diagnostic assessments that match specific skills and then analyze those scores, not compared to a benchmark now, but just whether those skills are well-developed for the age and grade level of a student. When we're looking for reading, the next slide shows the 5 key instructional components, well-known from the National Reading Panel. So we can diagnose concerns in each of these 5 areas, although truthfully we have better standalone tools for phonemic awareness, phonics and decoding, and fluency. There just are really not diagnostic assessments for vocabulary and comprehension, and we would just have to, that's a whole nother conversation about why that's true, but those are much, much more complex skills, and that's just a topic worthy of its own conversation. But on the next slide, I do have a checklist there for how, once we've collected diagnostic data, how should we use it? I believe we should go through a checklist like that, look at the scores and say, what are the student's strengths? What are their needs? How can we serve this student? Can we take care of this student's needs in the classroom only? Do we need to look at tier 2 or tier 3 services? Then we would need to look at tools. Are the tools matched, the instructional tools, the materials matched to the student's need, not just one size fits all, and making sure that whoever is going to use these tools or deliver the services has sufficient professional development and support, and then, of course, make sure that enough time is being given to the instruction of that student. So then continuing, once we've administered diagnostic data, or once a physician has, a physician would look over that data and come back to the patient and say, okay, here's what we found from our screening and diagnostic data, and then the physician would share the plan of action. What are we going to do? Do you need to change your diet? Do you need to increase your exercise? Do you need to take some medication? Do you need to have surgery? The physician would come up with a plan. For us, it shows on that next slide that our prescription is always involves some kind of instruction. We're going to provide instruction at the tier one level, supplemented by tier two or tier three, depending on the needs of the student. So then instruction is going on, or intervention is going on in the medical world. A physician would say, come to the patient and check in on how their things are going. How are they going? Are you feeling better? So what a physician would be doing is monitoring the patient's progress. And in our world, in the education reading, we have two ways of monitoring students' progress and two levels of intensity. That tier one, for the students who are on level, we really just can repeat those fall, winter, and spring benchmark assessments, and that can be sufficient for monitoring students' progress. If students are receiving tier two or tier three, we might want to look at something a little bit more intensive. So the next slide diagrams the fall, winter, and spring that for students on level. That is really along with daily observation by the teacher and the in-program assessments that come along with the program that we may be using may be sufficient. But for those other students, we might want to look at a procedure based, again, on that curriculum-based measurement research, now using it instead of for benchmark screening, using it for progress monitoring. And there are a whole bunch of procedures and that are used. Some of them look exactly like the procedures that are used for benchmark screening, but some of them, excuse me, I'm just being interrupted here for a second, sorry. The progress monitoring procedures are based on that same research base and follow the same basic procedures. But one of the key differences is that when we're using the procedures for benchmark screening, we're comparing students' performance to a benchmark. When we are using it for progress monitoring, we are comparing the student's current performance to the expected performance for that student. It's a slightly different interpretation and very powerful piece of information for our students who are receiving it tier two or tier three services. Using curriculum-based measurement or CBM for progress monitoring, again, is worthy of its own workshop. Some of you know these procedures very well, but if you don't, I want to just basically walk you through what it does look like using oral reading fluency. What we would do for a student where we're going to use this level of intensity is we're going to create graphs, and on those graphs we're going to be recording scores from oral reading fluency assessments that are conducted weekly, twice a week in some cases, every other week, once a month. How frequently to administer these progress monitoring assessments is really one of the decisions that needs to be made, and there's still emerging research about how often to do that. So this one slide I have says that since we're going to be doing a lot of assessments, we need to get a set of equivalent passages. We're going to monitor students in either their goal level, one level above where they're currently performing, or their instructional level. And I've put a little question mark by that recommendation, and there are several other question marks on this slide, to indicate that research has not yet given us definitive guidance about that. There is, I know of at least one study going on right now on this area about goal or instructional level passages to use. The general consensus from the research is to use instructional level passages. So if we were working with a student at the fifth grade level who was in fifth grade, but reading currently at the second grade level, we would be monitoring his progress using second grade level passages. And we would do that once a week, it says, or twice a month. And there's a question mark there. The frequency is still something to be debated, and we're exploring that as in research as well. Typically for CBM, for progress monitoring, we use one passage each time, but there are some discussions in the research about using two passages from time to time. But the remainder of the procedures are the same. We take each of those scores and put it on a graph. We have ways to determine a goal line or an aim line that we expect the students to, so we can monitor the progress that we expect. And then the next slide shows what we can do with that data. That the general rule from the research data is that if four of these progress monitoring scores in a row, consecutive scores, fall below the aim line or goal line that we've drawn, that the professional educators need to consider making an instructional change. And the question is then, what should we consider? And on the next slide, I have listed five broad categories. There's a lot of decisions that need to be made in each of these categories, but we need to consider whether we have matched the instruction well to the student's instructional needs. We need to consider whether the quality of the program and the quality of the instruction is sufficient. We need to be looking at the fidelity of instruction. Are the materials being used the way they were designed to be used? And that's one that I find in schools often we need to have discussions about, because good teachers do modify the curriculum. They do make adjustments and modifications, and sometimes that's exactly what needs to happen. Sometimes things have been modified or adjusted too much, and we've lost the impact of the program. And the other two categories of things to consider is the intensity of the instruction and the duration. Have we been providing the instruction long enough to consider, to expect to see some changes? And this progress monitoring has been around for a while. What we know is when it's first introduced to teachers as an option, they often don't find that this sounds very appealing. And a colleague of mine, Candy Einot, and I have a couple of times documented her own experience with CBM. She was a teacher, a Title I reading teacher and a special ed teacher in the Minneapolis School District right at the same time when the research was going on CBM at the University of Minnesota. And her school district was chosen to be one of the test sites for this newfangled idea. This was over 25 years ago. And all the teachers, the reading teachers, were told that they were going to be using these CBM procedures with every one of their students. Her reaction was very typical of teachers, and I've documented here on the next few slides that she said that her job was teaching and that she didn't feel she had enough job to teach as well as she wanted to anyway, and now she was going to take all this extra time away for assessing kids, and she was very worried about the time and the logistics, but also fearing what her students' graphs might show. You know, what if they showed that they weren't learning? She was concerned about the accountability factor, but she did do it. She was told she had to, and she dived in and used CBM. And her opinion also mirrors what I find with a lot of teachers, that after they use it, they become they get it, and they find that the little bit of time sacrificed is worth it. because it gives them so much good information. What she came to really appreciate was the how easily the graphs were could be interpreted, that you could see progress or lack of progress very quickly and make instructional adjustments. So she became a big fan. And in my references at the end of the handouts, I have referenced the article that she and I wrote called CBM From Skeptic to Advocate. We published that in the spring of 2007 in the Perspectives Journal. I've also included on the next slide some resources for those of you who would like more information on the use of CBM for progress monitoring. Some folks out of the University of Oregon have designed a website called easycbm.com. It's free access, free materials. It's a pretty amazing resource that won't be free forever. It's in a development stage right now, but it's a very powerful tool. Fluentreader.org as well has a lot of ideas and materials available for progress monitoring. The National Center on Student Progress Monitoring, this is your tax dollars at work. You have federally funded this Center on Progress Monitoring. They have webinars and conferences and downloadable materials and just a wealth of information to support the use of curriculum-based measurement for progress monitoring. So I would just like to sum up what we've talked about here, the use of assessment data for RTI. Started this conversation with focusing in on real kids. I used the pictures of those two students. What are we going to do about these students? Well, what we talked about was the educators as physicians analogy, where I believe RTI is taking us as professionals, starting with a framework based on research of making sure that we have all of these components in place, the standards, the assessments, instruction and intervention, supported by leadership and sustained system-wide commitment. And when we look at the assessments, there's a very clear parallel to what physicians are doing. We can start with screening, if necessary, do diagnosis of our students, and then use that data to teach them. Then we can monitor their progress and teach them based on that data, change our instruction or continue, and repeat as necessary so that we can, in fact, help every student become a full participant in their learning and growing. And in order to do that, we must teach all of our students to read. So I'm sure Mike will guide us through the next phases here, but I just want to point out in those last two slides, I do have some references, the CBM research review that I mentioned, and I will give a copy of that to Mike so that he can share it with all of you. The article that Candy and I wrote about her experience with CBM. I also put the article where Jerry Tyndall and I published some oral reading fluency norms that can be used for benchmarks and, again, that National Center for Student Progress Monitoring. And I also, the last slide there is two different websites for my new professional development company, Gibson, Hasbrook, and Associates. We are in developing a website for that. And my personal website for JH Consulting, if you want to get in touch with me personally after this phone call, that website, jhasbrook.com, is a very good way to do that, and I would look forward to hearing from you. So, that's it, Mike.
The conference is no longer in lecture mode.
Thank you, Dr. Hasbrook. We do have a few minutes for an open question or two from the audience.
Coaching.
So if there's anyone in the audience that would like to, I've taken the mute button off so that we can hear your conversations. If anyone would like to ask a question or two, we'd be happy to field it at this point. Does anyone have a question?
Yeah, I do, actually. It is 5170.
You have a question? Well, it doesn't seem like there are any questions. I usually don't have a timid audience in the educational world, but Jana, it seems like everyone got a little mum on us. Yeah, I'd like to thank Dr. Hasbrook and thank everyone for joining us today. And if there is any questions, please email them to us at straighttalklivechat@theinstituteforliteracyandlearning.org. You will be able to download any of these materials from the website, as Jan had mentioned to us this afternoon. And I'd like you to all to join me in thanking Dr. Hasbrook for speaking to us today, and if you could join me by a round of applause.
Thank you for joining us today at the Straight Talk Live Chat.
Jan, especially thank you for taking your time and sharing this wonderful information and giving us all these references.
Very welcome, Mike. My pleasure.
Everyone, have a great week.
Thank you.
Thank you.